said that parallels the temptation that Adam faced, that Israel faced. As soon as Israel is freed from slavery in Egypt, they're tempted in the desert. Adam and Eve were tempted. Two fails as God's trying to have people be his agents in the world. Jesus comes on the scene, he recapitulates or relives the story of Adam, of Israel. But this time, for the first time really in history, Satan is defeated. He's tempting someone and they don't fall. So Jesus is, by his very actions, beginning a new story for humanity. He's a new Adam. A new story for Israel. He's a new Israel. And so his start is good. He's already defeated the enemy one time at the beginning of his ministry. So he launches into his public ministry. He announces the coming of the reign of God. We said that Israel was on tiptoe, waiting for God to do something. They've been waiting like kids on Christmas morning. They've just been waiting and waiting and waiting, expecting God to act. And for centuries now, he's gone silent. There have been no prophets. There's been no voice from God. They're just suffering under foreign oppressor after foreign oppressor. And Jesus comes and says, the time has come. It's right now. I'm telling you, the reign of God is here. And he begins to demonstrate that with his mighty actions. He proclaims it with his words. He's announcing the coming of the kingdom, and he's inviting people in. We said his miracles, his mighty signs, weren't about proving that he was God. It's oftentimes the way they're interpreted. Not that he wasn't God, but that's not what those mighty signs would have meant to a first century Jewish audience. What Jesus is doing is showing his power over creation. He's calming the chaos monster, which is always associated with the sea in the ancient Near East and in Israel's history. Notice his miracles of calming storms on the water, walking on the water. That says he's over. He's more powerful than the chaos that's invaded the world. That's the way Israel and the disciples would have understood that. He heals people. Again, not just to prove that he's God, but to welcome people back into membership in Israel. These people who had these ailments, they were excluded from normal membership in Israel. They couldn't partake of everything. So he heals them so they become full members of the community again. All these things are welcoming people. He eats meals with the wrong people, people who were outsiders. Remember when we talked about all the different groups in Israel, the Pharisees, the Essenes? These people in particular were like, the reason God hasn't shown up lately is because we're not pure. So they're on this Torah intensification program. They're saying, we need to follow Torah more seriously. We're not serious about it. We're not obeying it to the letter. And those who are impure need to be kept out of our communities. They were hard on the walls, hard on the exclusion. Jesus eats meals with these people, compromisers like tax collectors, people who worked with the oppressors, the Romans. They worked for them. They took an extra cut for themselves. They abused the people, right? Sinners, others who didn't follow Torah scrupulously. Jesus welcomes them back and eats meals with them. So Jesus is making a big announcement. He claims that this is the time that God's acting. He embodies this new power in himself, and he's recreating Israel. So this week, we will talk about the other side of that. This is how Jesus portrays and frames and shapes his ministry. What about Israel's response? In particular, what about those who didn't think this was the best thing ever? Right early in Mark's gospel, we see the Pharisees and the Herodians getting together to talk about how they might kill Jesus. Like, early in Mark's gospel. Wait, what? Herodians? People who favored King Herod? They're false. Everybody knew he wasn't even Jewish. He portrays himself as the king of the Jews. Getting together with, and not a Torah observer, by the way, he could know less about Torah. He made pretenses of being Jewish. Together with the Pharisees who were all about getting Israel to be more serious about keeping Torah, they get together. What would possibly bring them together? Only opposition to Jesus is what brought them together. So, this week we're going to talk about what happens to those who aren't accepting Jesus' message, and what does Jesus say about them and about this moment in Israel's history. Now remember, these first 2 weeks about Jesus' ministry, it's all about Jesus the prophet. In coming weeks, we'll talk about Jesus the Messiah and the messianic kind of things he did and how he was accepting the title but changing the content or the meaning of that title within current day Israel. But for now, we're talking about Jesus the prophet. At the end of Luke's gospel, those disciples say, Jesus, this is when he's been killed and not yet risen, or at least they don't know that he's been risen. And they say, he was a prophet, mighty in word and deed. So the beginning of Jesus' ministry, as understood within Israel, was Jesus was finally another prophet from God, bringing an urgent message from God. So that's the standing. So, to get a beginning of a handle on that, look on the back of your sheet, and there's these three stanzas, oracles from the prophet Isaiah. What I want you to do is have somebody read that aloud at your table, and then I want you to simply talk about, as you read that thing, don't worry about every word or every line, but just read through the thing, kind of get the big impression, and then just say, what do you think Isaiah is talking about here? What does it sound like he might be talking about? And I'm not going to give you more direction than that. I want you to just kind of read it and talk about your initial response to what you think Isaiah might be doing by telling Israel these words. Okay, that passage that you're reading and talking about is from Isaiah the prophet. It's from early in the book of Isaiah. And if we had included the header, it would say, a prophecy about the fall of Babylon. Right? Babylon, big oppressor of Israel after Assyria. So this is a word of the Lord to Israel, but kind of obliquely to Babylon, about what is going to happen to Babylon on specifically what's called the Day of the Lord. You saw that phrase in there, right? Which is a big phrase in the prophets about this. It's used in various ways, but it's always about sometime when Yahweh is going to return and he's going to make things right. And it's a dark day for those who are not doing right. So some of the prophets say to Israel, don't you be looking forward to the Day of the Lord, thinking all your enemies are going to get it. And that you're going to get by scot-free. You yourselves are acting like them, so you will be treated like them. So the Day of the Lord is a dark day. It's a day of judgment, but it's a day of judgment leading to restoration. But the thing I really wanted to get at today in this was the dramatic language, right? The imagery of the language. It's like this table over here said, this is hard. This is hard language, right? It's impressive. Like, this is a day of complete disaster. It's painful. It's terrifying. And it seems to be destructive of the very fabric of creation. Did you notice that language about the stars and the moon? And, I mean, these are creation elements which are said to have gone haywire.
Did you know that we're going to have another blue moon this month?
We had, in fact, there was no full moon, right, in February. There were two full moons in January. That was a blue moon. That was a super blue blood moon in January, which, if you're an end times kind of person, that was like, whoa, this is a big deal, right? Because we're interpreting the signs in the Bible, like, things are going to go crazy, there's going to be blood moons.
Right? This is, by the way, just astronomically, like, incredible.
They have no full moons. It only happens once every 19 years. February, no full moon. A blood moon in January. Another blood moon in March. Meaning, January and March each have two full moons. That's where you get the phrase, once in a blue moon. Doesn't happen all the time.
So, people reading language like this, about moons turning to blood, of stars falling from the sky, the sun being darkened, are tempted to read it literally. And so, as we're going to see when we read Jesus referring to a passage with the same kind of language when he's speaking to Israel, and he says the stars will fall from the sky, the moon, the sun, the heavens are going to go crazy, right? Unusual things are going to happen. People also are tempted to read that literally. But in context, since we know this was about the fall of Babylon, and we read the prophets with understanding, we know that there's poetic language in the prophets, as there is in the songs of Israel, like the Song of Songs and the Psalms. Language like this is not meant to describe literally what's going to happen if you look up in the sky. Language like this is meant to describe the earth-shattering importance and characteristic of what's going to happen. The mighty power of Babylon, ruler of a whole section of the ancient Near East, is going to fall. God says he's raising up the Medes and the Persians. They're going to invade Babylon, and they're going to defeat them in battle. So, for all this language, right, it doesn't actually mean that that's physically what's going to happen. It's a way of understanding the language of the Bible. It's like that time, you can read the passage that's repeated both in the Psalms and in 2 Samuel, when David's life is spared when Saul's trying to kill him. Remember all those occasions when David's running around in the desert and David actually has a chance to kill Saul and he doesn't? And then he wakes him up and says, hey, where's all your bodyguards? I cut off a piece of your robe. I have it right here. I could have killed you. Why are you chasing me in the desert trying to kill me? And then David sings a song about how God rescued him from Saul trying to kill him. Now what actually happened is, they're out in the desert. Saul's got a band of soldiers. David has his men. And they're just running around chasing each other. And David's trying to survive. I mean, that's what actually happened. When you read David's description of this in Samuel, and then it's repeated in one of the Psalms, it sounds like God came down. He says, God, you rose up off your throne, you walked across the mountains, lightning bolts flashed, the skies rumbled, the earth cracked open, and you came down and saved me. That stuff actually happened. Again, in an ancient Near Eastern world, and in Israel's world, language like that is not meant to be literally understood. It's a way of saying, God, this is how important it is to me. This is how important it is to my story, the story of Israel. I've been anointed as king. I'm not yet king. In the scheme of things, again, this is earth-shattering. It's kind of like what we would say, like when the Berlin Wall fell. Right? It's an earth-shattering event. Again, there was no earthquake. We're not literally... It's a way of using language to say how important this thing is that just happened. Yes?
I love the phrase you're using, earth-shattering. That's not even literal.
Right.
We use that to describe that, but it in itself is not even accurate verbally.
Again, that's exactly it. And that's why I think it's important to respect the Bible to such a degree that we will read it on its own terms. And that means it isn't more holy to read the Bible literalistically. This is kind of a bonus session. You don't have to pay extra about how to understand language in the Bible. This means when the Bible is intending to use poetic language, we don't honor the Bible by not reading it as poetic language. We receive the Bible the way God inspired it to be, as different kinds of literature, different kinds of writing. So that's an important thing. So, when Babylon was defeated, for Israel, who had been imprisoned and sent into exile by Babylon, this is earth-shattering, right? It means that God is going to move in the heart of the king of the Persians to release the exiles in Babylon from Israel and send them home. It's a big deal in Israel's story. And so that's why Isaiah uses language like that. So, keep that in mind as we get to the finale of this section in Jesus about, and it's the topic of this day, the coming great judgment in Israel. Again, like all of Israel's prophets, Jesus is going to announce God's judgment on Israel, and then he's going to make a prediction, a prophecy, about what's going to happen to Israel if they persist in rejecting the message of Jesus. So, back to the other side of your sheet if you want to follow along. Let's remember, right? John and Jesus both. We announced that John the Baptizer was a prophet, the first prophetic voice in centuries. The people all recognize him as a prophet, right? Everybody kind of gets it. John is a prophet. He's filled with this passion and this fire. He's out by the Jordan telling people to repent and be baptized in the Jordan. We characterize that as a renewal of Israel ministry. John is not out there just saying, look, like in general, everybody in the world is on the outs with God, so like, it would be a good thing if everybody just got baptized. What he's doing is specifically an Israel thing. He himself lived in the desert. He's dressed like Elijah. Right? He goes out there, and so already the connotations are, wait, John's out in the desert, he's like Elijah. He's in the wilderness. Israel passed through the wilderness when they got freed from Egypt, and they're going into the land. And John's telling them to be baptized in the Jordan. You have to go through the Jordan again. He's telling them, repent. Do a do-over, start over as Israel, confess your sins, and as a nation, it was a national repentance. Not just every individual in the world has sinned, fallen short of the glory of God, and has to be baptized and repent and be saved. Right? That's not what he's doing. That may well be true, but this is an Israel thing. He's telling them, if you come to me and you get baptized, you're part of the renewed Israel. Getting ready, because God is about to show up. God is coming back to Israel. Jesus goes and he identifies with that baptism. Not because he was sinful, right? Because he's identifying with the national movement to renew Israel, to get Israel to start over as God's people, because they haven't been doing it well, and this is God's messengers coming and telling them to do it again. Jesus comes, and it's a continual thing with John's baptism. He's saying the same thing. This is an Israel do-over moment. So all the things we talked about last week, the miracles, the messages, the parables, the meals, and always remember, the symbols of Jesus, right, the things that he does are almost all of them symbolic actions. And pay attention to those as much as you do to the words of Jesus, because they mutually interpret each other. So Jesus chooses 12 disciples. Well, that would fit with an Israel renewal movement. There's a nucleus of a new Israel right there. So everything he does is about this renewed Israel, this call of God to invite them to change, because God has sent a prophet to Israel. He sent John, and he sent Jesus as prophets. And as we're going to see, Jesus comes not just as another prophet in a long line of prophets. He comes as the last prophet in a long line of prophets. So Jesus and John are calling Israel to this public national repentance, this do-over for Israel. So it raises the question, what happens in God's plan if Israel does not respond to John and to Jesus? How does Israel's story go then? And we shouldn't be surprised to hear Jesus starting to say, and by the way, the opposition to Jesus begins early in his ministry, and all it does is grow stronger. The people, right, those who are unaffiliated with official parties, like the people of the land, the peasants, they're pretty much loving what's going on. In fact, at one point, it says they're even loving watching the conflict between the Pharisees and Jesus, right? They're like the crowds. They're like, it's just fun to see people fight sometimes, right? They're not Pharisees. They're not Sadducees. They're not Essenes. They're not out, you know, writing the Dead Sea Scrolls in the desert. They're not zealots. They're not up in the hills trying to build an army to fight. They're none of the official parties, but they are the crowds that follow Jesus, listen to him, and respond or don't respond, but they're the bulk of Israel. So the question is, with all these parties, right, who keep following Jesus, with all these special interest groups, the whole array of them, with different agendas for Israel, what's going to happen to Israel if people as a whole, if the nation as a whole does not repent and commit to following the new way of being Israel that Jesus announces. He goes up on the mountain, he delivers a new Torah, he's like a new Moses, Sermon on the Mount. What happens if people don't live that way? He told them very specifically, these are the ways you're supposed to start loving your enemies. So you zealots up in the hills, quit fighting the Romans. God used to work through us fighting our enemies. This is a new moment. This is the big thing in the New Testament is this is the decisive moment in Israel's history. This is what everything else turns on, is what happens right now with this last in the long line of prophets. So if you don't accept this, the consequences are going to be very much like what the consequences always were for Israel when they didn't follow God's message. This isn't a new thing, right? In the whole book of Judges, it's a recurring cycle. When the people listen to God and are following Torah, he raises them up. They have a judge, he prospers. When they fall away, they fall under oppression from the Philistines or some other group. Then God raises up a judge to fight for them, and he restores them. But the message is always, if you don't listen to what God's call is for you, Israel, this vocation of being a light to the world, then the consequences are going to be not you'll be judged when you die in some post-mortem judgment scene out of Dante, right? The consequences are going to be historical. God is going to do something to Israel as a nation in the real world, in historical flow of events. So Jesus starts to say exactly the same thing. He's like, look, this is your last chance. There's not going to be another prophet after me. This is your chance to turn to God, because God is doing something decisive this time, once and for all. It's not like Assyria coming to the northern kingdom. It's not like Babylon coming to Judah. This is not one more of those things, and there'll be another one after that. This is the big one. This is the one that everything hinges on. This is why Jesus is so emotional on his journey to Jerusalem. In Mark's gospel, right? This is the gospel of Jesus sighing. I love that. I mean, I love the humanity of Jesus, right? It's like he's a mother of toddlers, right? Like, you just sometimes I'm wiped out. I can't do this. Jesus is sighing, right? He breathes heavily because he's distressed. Mark says, with the inability of his own disciples to get what he's doing. He's trying to tell them, okay, you acknowledge me as Messiah. I'm traveling to Jerusalem. And he tells them straight up he's going to die there. And they're like, this does not compute. Right? This doesn't fit our idea of what Messiah is. So that's a no-go, Jesus. Peter rebukes Jesus. Right after Jesus said, you just proclaimed me that you're the Christ and you're the Messiah. And then, like the very next sentence, Peter rebukes Jesus for saying he's going to Jerusalem to die. They won't get it. And as they're traveling along, Jesus is emotional. In Luke's travel narrative, he goes from Galilee to Jerusalem. Same thing. He gets emotional. He's crying in Luke's gospel. Because they come and tell him, Herod's looking for you and he wants to kill you. Jesus is like, no worry, I am not worried about Herod. Because Herod is not going to kill me, because Herod's up in Galilee. And any prophet, any good prophet in Israel dies in Jerusalem. Right? So, you're not going to get me in Galilee. I'm not even worried about Herod. I'm more concerned about what's going to happen to me, where I'm going. Where I'm going is Jerusalem. And then Jesus issues a lament for Jerusalem. He stops and twice. Once while on the way, and once while just before he gets to Jerusalem. Right, it's during the triumphal entry. He's entering Jerusalem as the Maccabean king, riding in with palm branches just like the Maccabean kings did. Right, he's replaying another historical moment for Israel, entering Jerusalem as a triumphant king. But just before he goes into the city, he stops on the hill and he looks over it and he cries. It says he weeps. Because Israel is not recognizing this moment in their story. What God is doing through Jesus, and Jerusalem is rejecting another prophet. And Israel is going to kill another prophet in Jerusalem, like they've killed and persecuted all the other prophets. And it's true. If you read the story, Israel was not too keen on the prophets, right? Jeremiah, I mean, read the story of Jeremiah. What these guys have to go through. Amos, right, he's from the south, he goes up to the north, gets charged with treason, they're trying to hunt him down and kill him. The prophets have a hard pull of it in Israel's story, and Jesus fits the pattern. He fits the pattern of the story of Israel, he's reliving it, and he himself is filled with emotion, because he's not concerned about everybody at this point, he's concerned about Israel. Because Israel is the tool, the means, the people, by which God has decided to change the world. God is going to save the world, but he's chosen to do it only through Israel. He's not just generically working with all humanity. He works with Israel, and salvation is from the Jews. So Jesus is all tied up with the story of Israel, and when they won't follow him, he knows the consequences. So,
let's go back to the outline here. So, Jesus is bringing his word. The confrontation was inevitable. Why? Because all the different parties, all the different factions, all the special interest groups and their lobbyists in Jerusalem, they all had their own agenda for Israel already. It doesn't line up with Jesus' agenda, so they all oppose him. Like, none of the major groups are with Jesus. He is alone with his small group of disciples. The crowds love him, but they're not really necessarily following everything that he does, right? He gets huge crowds, but as in John's gospel, as the sayings of Jesus get harder, everybody starts thinning out, right? At one point it gets so bad, his own disciples, his outsider group, I mean, he had like, remember in Luke's gospel, he sends out 72 disciples, so he has the group of 12, he has a group of 3 within that, kind of like David's mighty men, James, John, and Peter. And then he has this group of 72. He sends them all out. In John's gospel, as the sayings of Jesus get harder, the number of disciples thins out, and Jesus turns to the 12 and says, "Are you going to leave me too?" Right? It's getting worse as Jesus' ministry goes along in terms of commitment to his program. By the way, another aside, you get 2 bonuses today, and no charge for this one either. The second bonus is this. When a group of Jews in the first century kind of issue anathemas against each other, right, that's not anti-Semitism. They're not saying Judaism is bad. When the Essenes, who are out in the desert, who gave us the Dead Sea Scrolls, talk about the leaders in Jerusalem, they call them the sons of darkness. And we're the sons of light. Well, of course you are, because you're the holy ones out in the desert. But they basically, their story is, we're the real Israel. The rest of y'all, Texas, they would say, all y'all, right? You're no good. You are not the people who are faithful to God. God is going to work through us. The Pharisees said the same thing. We're actually the holy ones. We're the pure ones. We're the ones who are serious about obeying Torah. And the rest of you are not worthy of being Israel. The Sadducees, they're just political. They don't care really so much about being holy. They're just in power. They're the colleagues of the Romans. They benefit from it economically, politically. So they're just political guys. So all these parties, the zealots are saying, actually, God in our story works through the people who fight, like David, like Joshua, like Moses. So we're the ones who are just going to start the fight, and then God will show up. So they all had all these different stories. And when they call down anathemas saying, you're out, you're excommunicated, on each other in Israel, it's what Jews did in the first century. They were fighting for an identity. The identity of the true Israel was contested. That is, it was being fought for. It's kind of like today, just, I'm not into talking about the big political scene here today, but it's kind of like, who's a real American then? Who's a patriot? That, the meaning of those words depends on who you're with and what they are about. Right? I mean, people will say, that's not patriotism. People say, that is patriotism. That's calling America back to its ideals or whatever. Right? So the meaning of the word was contested. That's how it was in the first century. So Jesus is one more group, right? He's starting a movement alongside the other movements to say, this is the real Israel. This is where God's going to continue to do his Israel thing, is through me and my renewed Israel, my new 12 tribes, my new Torah given on the Sermon on the Mount. This is where God is now working. So Jesus is one among many.
So don't ever let anybody tell you, by the way, like Jesus in the first century or Christianity kind of has anti-Semitism built into it, because there are some strong sayings in like John's gospel, especially about the Jewish leaders. That's not anti-Semitism in a first century context. That's fighting for the identity of Israel like all the other Jewish groups were doing. It's an intra-Jewish debate about identity. So, again, bonus, no charge. So, historically, God's prophets always warned of a this worldly judgment. God, it's God's story, it's God's world, so when God brings judgment, right, they're not medieval Catholics here, right? These are first century Jews. They're not thinking in terms of when I die, I face a judgment, heaven or hell. Not to say anything about that pro or con at this point, simply to say that's not how they were thinking. Right? So when a prophet in Israel talks about judgment, it means judgment is going to come here and now in the real world, and it's going to come on the nation. It's not everybody lined up and you tell your life story and then you get a thumbs up or a thumbs down or something like that. So, in Jesus' case, he's the same as Israel's prophets. He too gives a prediction about historical judgment. So, two big things Jesus predicted. Number one, there's a terrifying judgment coming. He more or less said it's going to come from Rome. Right? In so many words, he says it's going to come from Rome. He does this throughout his ministry. So, a lot of these passages that we've interpreted as being about hell, word Gehenna, actually refers to this place outside of Jerusalem, this perpetually burning garbage dump. Right? And it's a historical reference. We have an expert on Gehenna right here in the room. John Dunham, sometime, should do a class for you about Gehenna and what it means in the Gospels and in the story of Jesus. It's fascinating. We read that word hell because most of our translations will translate the word as hell. We're immediately thinking, okay, Jesus is talking about that moment when you die and face judgment. Overwhelmingly, the passages in Jesus' Gospels are talking about a historical judgment coming on Jerusalem, coming on Israel. Okay. Second thing Jesus predicts, and his reputation, by the way, as a prophet is at stake here. If these things don't happen, right, if Babylon hadn't come and invaded Israel and taken the people into exile, that would pretty much tell you that Isaiah and Jeremiah and all these prophets were false prophets because they said it was going to happen. So their reputation as a true prophet of God is validated by what God actually does in history after them. And it has to happen. Jesus put his status as a true prophet of God on the line by saying this terrifying judgment is coming. If you don't change and follow me, if you don't follow my new way of being Israel, this judgment is going to come on you as it has come on Israel in the past. Number two, Jesus and his little circle are going to be vindicated, saved. Right? They're not going to be wiped out along with the nation of Israel. That's what Jesus predicted. In AD 66, right, Jesus dies 30-ish AD, right? That's when his crucifixion was. So the church is starting already to move out into the Roman Empire, proclaiming the gospel of a risen Jesus. But Israel, as a whole, did not turn and follow, they didn't accept Jesus' invitation. As a nation, overall, the leadership, they didn't change their ways as a nation. So God sent Rome as he had sent Babylon and Assyria earlier. And in AD 66, this revolution thing with the zealots in Israel has been going on for a long time, right? It kind of goes back to the Maccabees in the centuries before Jesus, and there's this revolutionary fervor in the air. So they keep picking fights with Rome. At some point, Rome says, okay, like we've had it. We're just done. And they invade. And when mighty Rome comes and invades Israel, Israel doesn't really have a chance. Right? Unless God were to show up and miraculously save them. It's kind of like they're like thinking, oh yeah, well, this is like David and Goliath. God is with us. It doesn't matter if they're Goliath and we're David. Because God is with us, we can still win. That's how the zealots thought. But God allows Rome to destroy them. You know the story of Masada? This is when that happens. Jerusalem is taken over again. The Romans come in. They dismantle the temple. We should just, I think we have enough time. I'll just read. It's in all the Gospels, the Synoptics. This story, right before Jesus himself is tried and killed, he talks about what's going to happen in this invasion. We'll read the version from Luke. It's in Luke chapter 21 if you want to follow along. If you have your Bible, doesn't matter. You can listen like original hearers of the Scriptures who didn't have their own copy. But Jesus, just before he's killed, when he's in Jerusalem for his final kind of, he's having it out with the religious leaders once and for all. One of his disciples start to ask him about the temple. So as Jesus is walking around, the confrontation with the leaders is getting hotter and hotter day by day. This is the week of Holy Week, leading to his crucifixion at the end of the week. So it's very close to his own death. Some of his disciples were remarking about how the temple was adorned with beautiful stones and with gifts dedicated to God. But Jesus said, "As for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down." They ask him a question. "Jesus, when will these things take place? And what will be the sign that they are about to take place?" Notice that the question is tangible, right? It's right in front of them. It's particular. It's about this temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem. And they're saying, when is this going to happen? And what are the signs about what is going to happen? And then Jesus gives a response, which is mostly taken to be Jesus' discussion about like the last day of history, or the return, or the second coming. And N.T. Wright, who I'm channeling, right? None of this, like I haven't made up any of this. So if you don't like his class, by the way, you can write to N.T. Wright. Because I everything I'm saying, I learned from him, right? So it's him. So Tom Wright says, they asked him about the temple, right? The question was tangible, and it was specific, and it's about a specific time. When is this temple going to be destroyed? Jesus has said the temple is going to be taken apart like a Lego house, right? Stone by stone, it's going to come apart. And then he says this, "Watch out that you are not deceived, for many will come in my name, claiming I am he. The time is near. Do not follow me. When you hear of wars and uprisings, do not be frightened. These things must happen first, but the end will not come right away." Right? Interpreters have said, well, it sounds like Jesus is suddenly talking about something else. He's talking about his second coming. And if you're reading historically, like we're trying to do, that's what this whole thing is about, you're saying, wait, Jesus? Like, the disciples don't even know that he was going away for the first time. Why would he start telling them about the second coming? Like, they don't know what the second coming is. They don't know what would not compute for them. All they're thinking about is the ministry of Jesus, the week before he dies in Jerusalem, and he just predicted the destruction of the temple. But Jesus' language, right, like the language from Isaiah that we read, is going to use language about the heavens and the earth shaking, the sky going dark, and people, because we're not reading the Bible the way the Bible was written, we think it's a literal description of the coming apart of the earth at the second coming. Then he said to them, "Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes, famines, and pestilence in various places, and fearful events and great signs from heaven." Have you ever heard that talked about by the end times folks? Right? They quote these verses, and they say, yeah, there will be wars and rumors of wars, more earthquakes. I know an end time site that counts earthquakes, right? It keeps a tab going of like how many earthquakes there are around the world and how many great signs, how many blood moons, how many blue moons, all this stuff, right? Because they're thinking that these things are literal things. But before all this, they will seize you and persecute you. They will hand you over to synagogues and put you in prison. And you will be brought before kings and governors. So this is what's going to happen to you. You 12 disciples who follow me, and those who join the movement because of you, this is what's going to happen to you. It's a very, again, specific and historical prophetic prediction. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, that should make it pretty clear, right? I mean, he's like not making this oblique or hard to figure out. He's telling them Jerusalem will be surrounded by armies. You will know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. There's this story about Jesus' followers, because of this word, when the Romans were approaching, actually leaving the city. They believed Jesus the prophet, so they weren't in Jerusalem when Rome came. This is the time of punishment, fulfillment of all that has been written. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant and nursing mothers. There will be great distress in the land and wrath against this people. They will fall by the sword and will be taken as prisoners to the nations. Jerusalem will be trampled on by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. There will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars. And on earth, nation will be in anguish and perplexity at the roaring and tossing of the sea. People will faint from terror, apprehensive of what is coming on the world, for heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time, they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. That's the line that makes people think it's about the second coming. Right? I mean, doesn't that sound like it? Remember the book of Daniel? I think we talked about this maybe in the other class that we did last summer. Anyway, whatever. So in reference to the book of Daniel, the Son of Man comes on the clouds in great glory. Except the thing is, in Daniel's book, this coming on the clouds in great glory isn't from heaven to earth. It's actually from earth to heaven. Like, we have to read it. Like, read the whole passage. So the Son of Jesus is not predicting that one day he is going to come back to earth on a cloud. That's not what he's saying. Although almost everybody like reads it that way. Right? What he's saying is, in the book of Daniel, God's people are persecuted, and God is going to raise up someone who will represent Israel, who will defeat those enemies, and then he will come into the presence of the Ancient One, the Great One, Daniel says. And he will come on clouds of glory. But he comes from earth and he comes into the presence of God in heaven. So it's actually, if you want to read this literalistically, you actually have to read it in reverse. Like, it would have to be a second ascension of Jesus or something, not a second coming. So go back and read Daniel 7. And then read this passage again. And you'll get at the meaning. The meaning is, God is going to vindicate his true people when the persecution comes. So the time of trouble will come, but God will save his people. And since Jesus has redefined who his people are, Jesus is all about a new Israel movement. Jesus has said, those who follow me are the Israel of God. They're the ones who are part of the new 12 tribes. They're following the new Torah. They've been baptized by John. They're renewed Israel. That's who God is going to come and vindicate when this terrible judgment from the Romans comes on Jerusalem. My people, my followers, will be saved from that. Because that judgment is because Israel's rejected God's last prophet. Wow, that's huge. And that interpretation of this passage is amazing, I think. I mean, it's counterintuitive from what we've heard for so many. Like, Jesus was always, and you know, at the end of this passage, he says, surely this generation will not pass away until all these things are taken place.
Can't take that literally.
That's the line that those who interpret it as a passage about the second coming, they don't know what to do with that line. Because they say, wait. So Jesus said all this, right? The earth and the sky is going to be convulsed, right? All this stuff is going to happen. Trauma like the world has never seen. But all of this will take place before this generation. This generation, he's talking about, before this generation passes away. Jesus the prophet, again, stakes his reputation as a prophet on that word coming true. And it happened in AD 70 when the Romans completely dismantled the temple and scattered the people of Israel once and for all. That's the moment Jesus predicted. It happened 40 years after he died, a generation. And that's what Jesus the prophet said is at stake in following me and listening to me and reconstituting Israel so that Israel will be the people who go out and bring the light of Jesus to the world. That's what the new Israel's job is. That's what Israel's job was always supposed to be, was bringing God's light to the world. Israel had become self-focused, self-absorbed, all about themselves. And Jesus is calling Israel back to their original vocation and the calling of Abraham. And he says, if you won't do this, then God's going to bring one more historical judgment. And that's the word of judgment that Jesus the prophet brought. We got a couple minutes. Any questions or comments or like this is crazy? I've never heard anything like this before. Yeah, and
so he got no credit for that as a prophet of Israel, right? Judaism didn't.
Right. But you know what's remarkable? Jesus doesn't get credit for this in Christianity.
That's right.
For this. Christianity doesn't talk about this. Tom Wright says AD 70 is huge. It's huge for the reputation of Jesus, for the story of Israel, for how God created a new Israel within Israel so that Israel could be Israel and bring the light to the world. And Jesus gets no credit for this prophecy. We don't ever talk about Jesus the prophet. We always want to talk about a little bit as the Messiah, mostly as God. And the story here is about Jesus the prophet bringing a message from God, an urgent message from God, and saying something specific is going to happen. And Christianity hardly talks about it. It's a weird thing.
We lose our end times theology as we talk about it.
That's also true, right? We couldn't talk about all the things, like, you know, if you go to the End Times Countdown website, where the clock is showing, like, how close to midnight we are, right? There's a little clock that shows you how close we are to midnight, right? We couldn't do that if we were reading this passage historically.
Right.
Yeah.
The major history comes from this area is from Josephus.
What's that?
Josephus.
Yeah.
78. That's the major history.
Where we learn, well, yeah, it's in Josephus, but it's everywhere. It's in the Rome. I mean, if you go to Rome, there's this depiction, like they show the Jews being taken on one of these wall reliefs, so they celebrate their victories. They show a Jew holding a menorah along with the prisoners about to be executed as one of their huge victories. So that's, I mean, it's not just like Jewish history or Christian history. This defeat of Israel in the 66 to 70 war, it's totally historically in the Roman story, I guess, public, not a secret history. So, yeah, good question. Yes?
It occurs to me that the Christian church, doesn't care about the church these days. And we have almost made Jesus the Gentile. And it's all about us. And it's interesting how, when you go back and think about the way God wanted, you know, to work through the Jewish name, he's sort of, but it's all now about us.
That's so spot on. I mean, that is exactly what we've done. And I think, she says we've made Christianity like, we don't care about Israel, we don't care about the Jews. We've turned Christianity into a religion that's just God and us. And we think that this stuff really doesn't matter. And you can see, I mean, Jesus wept about Israel's response. He wanted it to be another way. He said, I wish I could gather you under my wing like a hen gathers her chicks. Right? He has a heart for the people of Israel and the nation, and yet they don't accept him. And I think we've just, as Christianity moved out from Palestine into the Roman Empire, and non-Jews were welcomed into a relationship with the Jewish Messiah, they just ended up making it like, well, it's not Jewish. We just turned Christianity into a non-Jewish religion. And as if Jesus came and just said no to Judaism, like Judaism was the Old Testament and Christianity is the New Testament, instead of seeing it as the renewal of Israel by a prophet of Israel. That's the Christian story. And I think the less Jewish we've made Christianity, the less biblical we've made Christianity. Jewish is biblical, right? That's what the story of the Bible is, the story of Israel. And the reason we've got distracted with all this dying and going to heaven kind of stuff is because we don't believe the Jewish story about the goodness of creation and the renewal of creation that God is going to bring. That's what the end of the story is the end of God's, is the renewal of God's creation and his people within the world, not about just being someplace else and escaping earth. That's also the Jewish thing. So I think your comment is exactly right. But we're past time. Next week we'll talk about the symbols of Jesus' ministry, how he redefined all the key symbols that Israel was using at the time. We'll see you next week. Thanks for this.